our next speaker, Régine Debatté, will help you and explain you the internet of rubbish things and bodies and basically everything around it, e-waste. Thank you very much and welcome.
Can I get less light in the face?
Less light in the face?
Less light in my face. Less light in my face.
Light?
Light.
The light.
Can I get less light in my face?
Okay. A little bit less light for the speaker.
Yeah. Hello, good evening, everyone. First of all, I want to say thank you to Nora, to Gregor, and to everybody at the Chaos Communication Congress for welcoming me again this year. So I've been tasked with the mission, just like in 2018, to present to you some of the most interesting and exciting works in art and technology of this past year. And just like last year, I kind of went on my own way and went on a tangent and started adopting a tunnel vision. And for some reason, I realized I was obsessed with e-waste. So you're going to hear a lot about e-waste and nuclear waste in the coming hour, but still, I promise it's still going to be reasonably interesting, hopefully, and most of the projects are anyway from 2019. So why did I get interested and why did I think it would be a good idea to talk to you about e-waste? First of all, there was the theme of this year's Congress, resource exhaustion. I just decided to put a more, let's say, ecological twist on it. And then the second reason why I wanted to talk about e-waste is that a couple of months ago, I went to see an exhibition of a Swiss photographer who has spent 4 years, something like that, traveling around the world and trying to understand why transhumanists wanted to change and so-called augment and improve their body. And so he documented everything he found and how humans nowadays are changing their bodies, either to go from disabled body to able body or from able body to super able body. Alors, one way you can augment your body is, you know, it's with the RFID chip that you can implant and that allows you to get access to offices, open your car door, or even pay for public transport. And I've been told recently that RFID chips are the new tattoo. And then you can also get a magnet implanted underneath your finger that allows you to sense electromagnetic fields. And actually, the first time I heard about this, I was at least 10 years ago. It was one of the first Chaos Communication Congress I attended in good old Berlin. And there was this this journalist called Quinn Norton, and she came to explain that she had just had a magnet implanted, explain the new experience and how she felt magnetic fields. Anyway, I could multiply the example, but of course the people who are really at the cutting edge of body improvement and augmentation are the transhumanists. So this is one of them, Igor Trapeznikov. He's part of the Russian transhumanist community. He had a number of implants, you know, the usual RFID chips, but also a device that turns sights into sound, which is usually useful for people who have vision problems or who are blind. And then, of course, there are addition to the body or correction of the body that are there for therapeutic reasons, so that's how some find themselves with bits of titanium in the knee or in the shoulder, and they use this kind of screw. I think that's one of the images in the series that I found the most impressive, the idea that when I get old, I might get this kind of screws inside my body. Pacemaker, of course, and what makes pacemaker interesting is that it was one of the first electronic devices that found its way inside our body, so it became kind of emblematic of the coming mechanization of the human body. And then, of course, there are the other devices that communicate with the with electronics that you insert in the body, and that communicate with phones and computers. So that's why some are talking about the Internet of Bodies. You know, after the Internet of Things, there's the Internet of Bodies. So this is a bioartificial pancreas for people who suffer from diabetes type 1. Okay, so there are so many smart devices that can be added on your body or inside your body. I've heard about smart contact lenses and so also smart prosthetics. And after seeing this exhibition, I started looking at people around me with a different eye and wondering who else had bits of metals and electricity and electronics inside their body. So that's where my obsession with e-waste came, because my immediate question after this is, what happens after you died? What happens to that? So I don't know if you're interested, but I had to do some research. So if you are buried the traditional way, you're buried with all your gadgets and your gizmos and anything orthopedic. If you are cremated, you're not cremated with the pacemaker, because it contains batteries, they could explode. And then I learned about a new very interesting service. I mean, to me it sounded quite interesting, is that when you are cremated, of course, the titanium or any metal, they are not burned. So there's this company who retrieves all the metal that is found among the ashes. There's a couple of companies around the world who do that. And they just recover all the metals. They divide them according to the types of metal, and then they melt them down into ingots, which they sell to the medical industry, but also to the car industry and the aeronautical industry. So that means that parts of these bodies are going to become part of a car or a plane one day. And I also started imagining that probably in the future, you know, archaeologists will find skeletons with e-waste. We will be buried simply with our e-waste. They will find bits of metals in the shape of bones and then rusty electronics. So that's really what set me on the path of starting to see e-waste absolutely everywhere. Yes. I never miss an opportunity to show my dog, because I realized that he has an RFID chips, and apparently all pets are buried with them. Anyway, splendid animal. So since I'm talking about e-waste, it's difficult not to mention one of the icons of e-waste. It's Agbo Bloshi. I'm sure you've seen the picture, so I'm not going to... I mean, I'm going to show images, but... I'm not going to tell you the whole story, because I'm sure you've seen all these images. So it's located in Accra, the capital of Ghana, and that's where full containers of electric and electronic trash end up. And the press really like to talk about it and say, oh, this is where your data and your devices go to die. It's a huge place, and you've seen the images of these young people who spend the whole day dissecting your devices and trying to separate different types of precious metals, such as aluminium, silver, copper, etc. Of course, they work in terrible conditions. It's very toxic to work there. They all suffer from terrible headaches, difficulty sleeping, respiratory problems, untreated wounds, etc. But it's really usually the way the press is depicting what's happening at Agbo Bloshi is really not depicting the full story. There are bits and pieces missing in the narratives. First of all, I think we are not conscious enough of the role that this, like the really important role these people are doing for us, because they retrieve metals. And we have the feeling that metals are everywhere, but on the surface and underneath the earth, some of them are going to be more and more difficult to retrieve. So this year, UNESCO declared the year of the periodic table. And you can see on this periodic table that the dots in red and in orange are the types of elements that are going to be more and more difficult to mine and to retrieve. I like to show this graph. It's a bit old, it's not very precise, but it shows the trend. So if ever you have a child or a brother who was born in 2010, by the time your child or your brother or your sister is 20, there will be no antimony, no lead left to mine. Very little indium, very little zinc, very little silver, almost no gold. So you see, these elements will still be there, but it's just going to cost more and more energy and more money to retrieve them. So that's why you have this project of mining very deep into the ocean or even mining asteroids for the same kind of metals that we need. And I think also that metals are kind of, we kind of have a blind spot for metals. We forget, we take them for granted. And when we think about the challenges of the environment, we tend to focus on energy, and energy is important. But when you think about renewable energy, we have the feeling, well, it's zero emission, but it still has a big impact on the environment. And I like to talk about this solar thermal plant. It's a famous one. It's a very, very big one. It's in Southern California. As you can see, it's vast. And actually, when it was being built, conservation biologists were very concerned because it was actually built on really environmentally intact desert habitat for a number of animals which were endangered, such as turtles that had to be moved by hands and put on a truck and relocated elsewhere. Some of them died out of stress. You might have heard that also birds and bats by the thousands every year, they die because of the heat and the radiation. And also you see the surface of the earth that this is occupying. It's really huge. And I think it's not a coincidence if the opening sequence of the sequel of Blade Runner 2049 starts with this seemingly endless landscape of solar panels that are necessary to power modern life. So, yes, as I said, I think we don't perceive the importance of materials and how many components extracted from the earth are inside any object that surrounds us. So I'm going to show a couple of examples of design work and artworks that try to make visible the elements that are inside our electronics or electric objects. So the first one is by these designers called Studio Drift, and they have a series where they decompose all kinds of objects. I'll show a few of them. They can be bikes, they can be mobile phone. In this case, it's an iPhone from a model from 2010. It can be hovers. I'll show a few examples. And so they dissect them and they analyze the elements that compose them, and then they restitute these elements in the form of this geometrical shape. So I'm going to show a few of them. So that was the iPhone. That's good old Nokia from 1999. When you see them in exhibition, they are really tiny, and I think also that some elements are simply not represented. If you think about rare earths, some of them are present in smartphone in really tiny quantities, like less than half a gram. But I couldn't find another image, but this is very big. So this is the representation of a Volkswagen Beetle from 1980. And so that took a lot of space. And you see elements that appear that I was really not expecting, such as horse hair and also cork. This is an electric cable. So, you know, a bit of copper and a lot of plastic for 1 meter. Ah, that's my favorite, the Kalashnikov. You see the bullet in the front. And when I went to see, the first time I saw this exhibition, you know, if I didn't look at the label, I had no idea what was what. I could not recognize anything. So it shows the level of ignorance of or at least people like me. But that I could recognize, the pencil, that I could manage. So that's the last one. So that's a light bulb. So that's one way to visualize the elements that surround us. It's very designy, it's quite elegant and charming. But I'm going to... I also like artists who adopt a more brutal strategy. So Danny Pluger also wanted to show the inside. Well, that was one of his objectives, at least, to show the inside of electronic devices. So the first part of his project started back in 2017. He infiltrated Philips and got hired as, you know, this guy you see at these consumer good fairs that try to sell you gadget and say, well, this is going to change your life and here's what this can do. So he was hired to sell a highly sophisticated shaver for men. And the reason why he wanted to be there is that he wanted to understand exactly what were the dynamics and the logics behind the constant rapid innovation behind our electronics. So that was the first part. He got his hands on confidential material that really explained how people at Philips, they have these teams, I say Philips, but I'm sure it's the same elsewhere, of course, they really analyze the kind of the different types of consumers that we are and find the best way to trick us and to lure us and seduce us into buying new products. And then the second part of his project was this year, where he bought this machine. It's a machine that is called an industrial stress testing machine. So there are several of these machines. You can buy them. He bought this one on Alibaba in China. And they're usually used by makers of shavers, mobile phones, whatever. And they simulate all kinds of accidents that can happen to your device, like walking on it or dropping it. I'm going to show a video of this one. So that's our poor shaver inside. I like the machine because, you know, it has a bit of a vintage-y feel inside. The objects that it tests are quite sophisticated and very, very much 21st century. But when you see the control panel, it seems to be stuck in the mid-20th century. It has this kind of old design. Apparently, it was a nightmare to get it shipped to Europe. It cost more to get it shipped than the machine itself. And if you're like me and you could watch this video for hours of the arm rotating and breaking things, and if you live in Leipzig, the machine is going to come to the Museum of Fine Art in March as part of an exhibition called Zero Waste. Anyway, so the reason why he did this like obscene display of destruction of a luxury good was that he had two reasons for doing that. The first reason is that usually when we think about consumer culture and how we consume too much and throw away too much and waste, the onus usually is on the consumer. You know, the consumer is wrong. And yeah, we are wrong, we buy too much. But then the wrong starts actually much further upstream. It starts everywhere in the line of production, and especially in the design and research and development team who engineer constantly new ways to seduce us and to convince us that we have to update. And then another reason why he did this project is that he wanted to make a comment on maker spaces, which, you know, they are very interesting, but they're still feeding on this vocabulary of entrepreneurship, innovation, progress. But they never really truly and deeply and they don't really challenge in a systemic way consumerism. So he saw this laboratory of electronic aging as a kind of maker space for unmaking things. And also you get to see what's inside this piece of electronic. But I would like to go back to Agbo Blocher again, because if there are people who know very well what's inside our electronics and what they are made of, it's the workers in Agbo Blocher. And sometimes, you know, when we think about this kind of place, I take the example of Agbo Blocher, but as I'm sure you know, there are e-waste dump sites elsewhere in Africa, also in Asia and Bangladesh, etc. We have the feeling that this is a big junkyard, and that it's a kind of huge mass, and it's dark and it's dirty. But this is a map done by architects, designers, and activists who spent a lot of time in Agbo Blocher. And you probably cannot read. Well, you probably all have better eyes than me, but it's still written very small. They map the activities at Agbo Blocher, and if you read the map, you see that there is a maker space. There are spaces dedicated to disassembling. There are places to eat, to pray, to disassemble, to repair, to have fun. And also, we have the feeling that these are just people discarding and dissecting our electronics. But actually, the way they work is very sophisticated and very fine. So first of all, they get these huge containers that contain pretty much anything we don't want that's electric or electronic, including entire cars. And they divide them in streams. So this is a heap of photocopy machines. They also... They can detect when something cannot be repaired, but they also can detect which part of the machine or the computer is still, which component can be saved and reused to repair something else. So that also goes on the pile. I think they are much better than us at differentiating different types of plastics. They have places dedicated to weighting the kind of metal that they retrieve. And I would say they are quite like you, certainly not like me. So when I have a computer and it doesn't work, for me, it's a black box. I'm never going to open it. But these people, their job, their business is to open our old computers. And better than that, most of them, many of them, can repair and give them a second life, a new lease of life. Which, you know, it's important because we think all these objects are dead, but actually they give them a second life. And then, you know, they repair them, they sell them to communities around Agbo Blocher or in Ghana or neighboring countries, to people who would otherwise not be able to afford a new printer, a new TV or a computer. And then, as you can see, they have places to have fun, and they too are quite fans of the Premier League. So the map I was showing just before with all the activities in Agbo Blocher has been made by architects and designer Dike Oziwazare and Yasmin Abbas. They spent a lot of time trying to understand how the community was working, and they designed this kiosk with anything they could find on the scrapyard. And it's a meeting place where they invite the community of Agbo Blocher to meet people such as graduates or young students in science, technology, engineering, math. And so the students and graduates who have very, very theoretical vision on technology, and then they get to meet these people who have an extremely sophisticated, very deep know-how, and together they exchange ideas and they've developed ways, for example, you know, they traditionally to recover the copper from the cable, they would burn the cable, the plastic, which is very toxic, and also damages the copper. So they find a way to recover the copper without burning the plastic, which means that it's less toxic, it's safer, and they can sell the copper for more money, so it's kind of win-win. they also developed together new processes, new ways of working, new tools. They also have fun, so with bits and pieces they found on the scrapyard a couple of years ago, they made these drones that flew over the junkyard. So it's a project I like a lot because it pays homage to a kind of work that doesn't get a lot of recognition, but that's really important. You know, when you think of, as I said, the metals we are using to make our electronics and also even the solar panels and the wind turbine, etc. All our renewable energy, they also rely on the same metals that are disappearing, at least are becoming less available. So that's one of the reasons I really like this project. And also it reminded me of this performance from already 40 years ago by Mirle Laderman Ukeles. She kind of decided she would be an artist in residency at the New York Department of Sanitation, so that's the people who collect the trash. So she spent a year with them every day. She was there at 6 in the morning, and she followed them, and she had this gesture of she wanted to meet every single one of them. There were 8,500 employees, so she wanted to shake them with them and say, thank you for keeping New York City alive, which I think is a lovely gesture because suddenly this anonymous mass of bin men, you realize that they are individuals. And yeah, she documented and talked with them. And yeah, it's a way to bring attention to a profession that we don't value a lot. And also, she wanted, by spending so much time among them, to make people realize that the work of these people should be valued at least as much as her own as an artist because of the role they play for the collective society. Yeah, okay, I insisted on Agbogbloshie, but if I had time, I would talk about other projects in Africa. This one is a startup, African-born 3D, that makes 3D printers that at least a third of the components are found in discarded electronics, let's say. And I think what they show is a kind of mindset and an attitude that should inspire us. I'm just going to show you a few examples of this attitude. I think is really important. Is trying to make the most of what you have instead of jumping on the next gadget and gizmo, but really trying to be as creative, as innovative as possible. So in India, they have this movement called Jugad, where in the West we translate it as frugal innovation. So this is a guy who had only a motorcycle. He needed a plowing machine for his land, so he adapted the his motorcycle and he turned it into a kind of I can take a traveling mic, huh?
Dead battery.
So I should keep now it's my hair.
Yeah.
In the meantime, the question, you know it. Oh no, I think the meantime is over. No, still. You know the question and you know the case. 6 to 1? Someone? No? 6? So 6 hours of sleep a day. 2 meals. No? Oh, boring. Anyways, thanks. To remember it, 6 hours of sleep, 2 meals a day, and 1 shower. Please remember, and to make some minor announcements, don't forget your trash. Do we have audio back?
I think so.
Ah, perfect. Then, please.
I can't believe you've told people to wash. Yeah, Jugad is answering precise need instead of creating demand. And sometimes, you know, it responds to a specific problem. Sometimes it can be scaled up. So this Indian inventor made a fridge that doesn't use electricity. It uses evaporation to keep the food cool, simply because there are people who live in rural area who don't necessarily can afford a fridge or don't have continuous access to electricity. And of course, the best example and the most famous example of Jugad is the Indian Space Mission. Since 2014, India has is a probe orbiting Mars. And the Indian engineers and pretty much everybody in India jokes about the fact that it costs less money for them that the space mission costs less money than your average Hollywood blockbuster about space. And you know, it's not about making things cheap. It's about reinventing process of designing manufacturing and of distributing. Okay, I don't have that much time, so I'm going to skip a few things. So I've been to India, Africa. Let's get back to Asia, because I really like this project. It's a project by an artist who also saw images from Agbo Bloshi and similar junkyard. And so he was interested in e-waste as well. He found himself in Taiwan. And he found this really cutting-edge company that deals with e-waste no one wants. So usually when you find a company that deals with recycling metals, usually they focus on the nice metals, the ones that are valuable, like copper, for example. But then you have pieces of electronic waste that no one wants, such as, I don't know, the one that contained lead, or CRT monitors, or glass fiber from printed electronic boards. This kind of thing that really no one knows what to do with it. Well, they found a way. So the company is called Super Dragon Technology. And the trick they found is that they just take all these bits and pieces of waste that no one wants, and they crush them into a powder, they mix them with epoxy, and they make these splendid objects out of them. And because I think they're quite crafty, they can imitate very well the appearance of bronze, of marble, of porcelain, you know, very noble material. And also they play with the proportion of epoxy and this toxic powder to make it feel like it's very heavy if it's supposed to imitate bronze, etc. And so they are decorative objects with the particularity that they contain a lot of lead, so you're not supposed to manipulate them too much. It might be dangerous. They also have in common that they have a very peculiar aesthetic, as you can see. This is a trophy. And then they have this wonderful little thing where they make fake rocks, which looks absolutely eccentric and crazy, but the story is that these are not just any type of rocks. They are supposed to be scholar stones. So during the 10th, 11th, and 12th century in China, there was this passion for the so-called scholar stones, where an intellectual from China would go in the countryside and admire the landscape, and suddenly they would find these rocks that seemed to be sculpted by the elements that had really strange and interesting shapes. And they thought it was the manifestation of the creativity of nature, and so they would bring them back and use them to contemplate and meditate. And you know, nowadays you can still buy some of these scholar stones in auction. They are quite valuable. But what I really, really like is that this Super Dragon technology is the way they think. So they kind of figure out that there's a difference between applied art that makes, you know, useful things like plates and furniture, and then fine art that makes basically useless things. And since the waste no one wants is useless, well, that kind of fits with the requirement to make fine art. So that's why all these objects I've been showing to you, they call them green art, and they have a green art gallery. And apparently it's quite successful. Taylor Coburn bought some of these stones, and he actually accompanies them with a text or an audio narrative where you have the story of one single grain of sand that tells its many stories, or it started as a sand and then became a piece of electronics and then a piece of trash and then ended its life as art. I found it very charming. I don't have time for this. Yes, very quickly. I mean, I'm famous for giving very depressing talks, so now I'm trying to insert a little bit of happiness in my talks. Things are changing a bit. That's why you have now repair cafes that are quite successful. Yeah, there are also shops you can find where the people working there, they're absolutely not affiliated with Apple, Samsung, and Nokia, but they found a way to give a second life to your objects and repair them. So, and usually they are much nicer than the guys at the Genius Bar, if you've ever had to deal with them. There are more and more websites that sell second-hand goods that have that even come with a one-year warranty. You've heard about the Fairphone, of course. And then brings me quite abruptly to the other type of waste I wanted to talk about, which is nuclear waste. I thought I needed to talk about nuclear waste because it's waste, because it's energy, and so it's very technological and extremely problematic. So what do you do when you have your country and you have a lot of nuclear waste? I mean, the most toxic can be toxic for 100,000 years up to a million years. It's going to be very, very dangerous. You have two choices. Either you keep it at hand, like buried but not too deep, so that you hope that in the near future someone will have a brilliant idea and be able to will know what to do with it and handle it safely. Or else you do like they are doing in Finland and in other countries, and France is thinking about that. You bury them very, very deep under the ground in a deep geological repository. But then you have a problem, because it's going to be dangerous for, you know, thousands of years. So how do you inform people, like future generation, that it's dangerous and they shouldn't go nearby? Either you use text, but then languages change, languages disappear. I mean, we might think that, oh, everybody speaks English, but everybody used to speak a bit of Latin, and now if you're in front of confronted with a text of Latin, you might not find it easy to understand. Even if your mother language is English, dealing with an English text from the Middle Ages is going to be difficult. I speak French, dealing with a French text from the Middle Ages is difficult. So how about having some nice icons such as the skull and crossbones? Like everybody, you would think that everybody associated with toxicity. Absolutely not. It's quite new. It's only since the 1800s that the skull and crossbone has been associated with toxicity in the Middle Age. Christians, when they saw skull and bones, they thought renewal and resurrection. I guess if you show the children the skull and crossbone, they are not going to say, oh, toxicity. They are going to say, oh, cool, pirates, treasure island. So you see, that's tricky, yeah, the symbols. So I'm going to show a couple of ideas that semioticians and artists and philosophers and thinkers have thought about to deal with how to signal to very, very distant generation that there is something special there and that you shouldn't go near it. Oh, yeah. Okay, I forgot this one. Even if you found a suitable message, let's say you found a suitable message, you also have to make sure that people will take it seriously. Like dotting the coastline of Japan, there are these so-called tsunami stones that basically say, please don't build beyond this point because it's very dangerous. There's been tsunami. They will come back one day. No one paid attention. Anyway, let's go back to my artist and semiotician's idea. So in the early 80s, a semiotician had the idea of, you know, to preserve the memory of of the presence of very toxic, very dangerous nuclear waste. You have to make it part of society, to include it in the fabric of society. So he suggested the creation of an atomic priesthood. So that would be a religious order that would have as its mission to keep the memory of the danger alive using rituals and myths and folklore. Some artists thought, well, we should plant a forest, like a forest of genetically modified trees on top of one of those repositories so that in the autumn the leaves would bloom and become blue and that they would fall and that they would be a nice blue carpet, and people will, like in thousands of years, will interpret it as, oh, this is a sacred place, we should leave it in peace and respect it. I really love this idea. I find it a bit naive because, you know, human beings don't have a great track record of respecting beautiful pieces of landscape. So, yeah, I'm not very optimistic. And then there's this kind of cynical idea of modifying a cat so that the cat would start glowing or changing the color of its fur in the presence of high radio. Oh, I'm 20 minutes again. I keep adding time. But I'm almost done anyway. So that would be a cat that change colors or glow in the presence of radioactivity. This is not one of those cats. It's an artistic interpretation of by Marcel Rickli. So, I think it's not very nice, but... to be honest with you, I like all those ideas of trying to transmit and connect with very, very distant time and with people who live in moments in times we cannot even comprehend and imagine, but I'm not totally convinced. I mean, they are charming, but I don't think they would stand the test of deep time, mostly because it's just, I mean, the periods we're talking about, like even 100,000 years, it goes beyond human experience. How do you relate to it? It's just so far away that it becomes abstract and almost unreal. So I've been thinking, you know, about this project. I've been interested in nuclear waste for quite a few years now. So I've been thinking, are there projects, artistic orders, that can relate to, like, physically or emotionally, with very, very distant past, but in the distant times, but in the past, because we know the future, we don't know what is going to be like, but the past, we kind of have an idea. And I couldn't find any project that really, that I was convinced could give a good experience, a good idea of relating to a distant time in the past. Until last month, there was this big art fair in Turin, and I found this butt plug. By a Swedish artist called Thomas Ammon, and the particularity of this butt plug is that it's made of coprolite, so it's basically dinosaur poo from around 140 million years ago. And that's where I discovered that there's actually a big market for this incredible, that with for fossilized dinosaur excrements. You can buy it, I checked, you can buy it on Amazon. I'm not sure it's going to be authentic, but it's available on Amazon. So I thought, yeah, that's it. I mean, if you were to buy it and use it, you would actually be in close connection with a living creature that, in intimate contact, I could say, with a creature that lived at a very, very distant time. Okay, so we're almost at the end. I have three lines of conclusion that I'm going to read, but then I want to show you a film. And my conclusion would be that all of this is very fanciful, especially the end, but it might still be useful to keep in mind that something like renewable energy that keeps us so passionate is very often viewed as a long-term solution to the climate emergency. But unfortunately, renewable energy relies on physical resources that are neither infinite nor renewable. And right now, it looks like we are busy implementing a future that was dreamt and conceived a few decades ago, at a time when society wasn't worried about exploding climate crisis, the erasure of wildlife and a growing material scarcity accompanied by unmanageable heaps of waste. Anyway, I've just been talking about the future, and I would like to end with a short movie set in the future by Alexandre Loupachko, who's a young Russian filmmaker. And I really wanted to show it to you for several reasons. One of them is that when I knew I would come back, my first thought is like, yes, I'm going to be able to show 2050 because I really love it. And the second reason is that I really didn't want to finish my presentation with a butt plug.
Вчера в главном офисе компании Robotech состоялась торжественная презентация роботов четвертого поколения. В наступившем 2050 году...
Торговый центр Robotland работает круглосуточно.
И тогда ежик сказал роботу...
Наконец, мечта человека...
Здравствуйте.
Здрасте.
Вас приветствует компания Oriflame. Желаете ознакомиться с обновленной линейкой продукции? Мы рады, что вы заинтересованы.
Мужик, не стреляй, я не робот. Вот, сопли, глаза посмотри, я не робот.
Ага. А вдруг ты четвертого поколения?
Нет, я человек.
Точно не робот?
Нет. Это ключи, мужик, вот ключи. Убери ствол, я не робот, я человек.
Отметь здесь дорожные знаки.
Кожаный ублюдок.
I forgot to say it had nothing to do with waste, but it was just irresistible. I had to show it to you. Okay, that's it for me. unless you have questions.
Thank you very much, Régine Debattie. As usual, if you have questions, we have microphones over there and microphones over there. Please stand in line, and of course we have questions from the internet. Okay, in the meantime, a small thing. If you want to read more about Regine, she writes also on a website. It's called wemakemoneynotart.com, which is, at least at my, as I'm concerned, a brilliant title. And you write about what?
I've been writing, I think it's for almost 16 years, about the way designers, artists, and hackers are using science and technology in a creative, but more importantly, socially engaged way. So it's quite political, I like to think.
Which suits perfectly to this event.
Yeah.
So, questions. I see not so far. Not so far. In this case, we can... number four, is this? No. In this case, I heard an No question. In this case, we can chat a little bit more about your website.
Okay. So,
if you want.
Oh, yeah, but it's not going to interest people.
I'm pretty sure it does.
Okay.
Because I had a quick look, and it was pretty impressive. You write about AI, as far as I know.
You know, that's the thing. When I knew I was coming to talk about the best of 2019, I was like, this year I've had to deal so much with AI, even outside of my blog. And I said, no more AI, except maybe for the film at the end, that kind of, you know, it's a bit AI, but otherwise...
No AI.
On my blog there's been a lot of AI, yeah. I'm a bit sick of it. Actually, one of the last I wrote about was by Julian Oliver, who spoke just before me now. Yeah.
Cool. In this case, no more questions. Thank you very much. Please, a warm applause. Regine.